history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you that if you take the time, if you go and ask them a few questions and take the time to listen, you're going to hear some things that might knock your socks off. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to meet a member of that generation today, 90-year-old Albert Henderson of Clovis, California. Born in Salt Lake City, grew up on California's central coast in Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo. And maybe you bought some meat from him in San Luis Obispo at the Ellsworth Meat Market once upon a time, or maybe he cooked a meal for you at the iconic Madonna Inn there that probably a lot of you have been to. But today we're sitting in his home in Clovis, California, and we're going to hear about a place far, far away and why he ended up floating in the ocean for a few hours. Let's start before that, though, Mr. Henderson. Growing up as a young boy, I know you lost your mother before you were even 2 years old. Is that something that affected you early on, or was that just the way life was?
No, because I didn't know the difference. I lived with my aunt. She wanted to adopt me, and my dad wouldn't stand for it. And there's a big family kaboo about it. But I really thought she was my mother because my mother died in 1927. I was just two. And she took me back to Kansas, and I stayed back there till I was a little over four, and then I went back to my grandmother, which was my mother's family in Salt Lake City. My sister was there, my only sister I had at the time. So then my father come and got us, and that was a whirlwind of hurts and wants and disappointment and life.
Sure.
So.
Had to grow up in a hurry.
Yes.
What was life like before World War II? I hear so much from people your age about life during the Great Depression. In some areas, people were really impacted by it, and other areas, not so much. What was your experience during those years?
Trying to get enough to eat. That was the main object, and save enough for your family, brothers, sisters, and trying to be a provider. What was yours wasn't really. It belonged to everybody. And I would sell whatever I could come across. I would clean yards for a dollar and all the wine bottles I could find, because it was worth 2 cents a piece. And I'd done boil laundry for a dollar a batch, find the wood, make the fire, boil the water, boil the clothes, scrub them, and hand them back dry for a dollar.
Hmm.
I'd work a half a day or longer.
And how young were you when you were doing that?
7.
7 years old. You were boiling people's laundries to help support the family so you and your siblings could eat.
Yeah, and then we was picking cotton like in Buckeye, Arizona, and living 5 of us in one tent with a combustion stove, which was tin. And that was, everybody just lived there and only had one bed, 3 pallets.
Hmm.
But that was bad in the winter. But winter wasn't last long because we had to leave and go pick crops in Washington and Idaho. And
so you guys would go wherever there was something to do and some money to be made.
Yes, because we could get enough to get out of town, and then that was the key to the whole thing. Find out where the crops were, hops for beer or potatoes for whatever, and wherever we was at, that's what we ate.
Well, I'm sure for a few years there, then the only ambition you had was keeping some food in your stomach and getting to another day. But was there a point where you thought, you know, when I grow up, I'd like to do X, Y, Z? Do you remember any of those dreams or ambitions?
Well, yeah, because my dad's brother was in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
And early on in the 30s, why, he said, that's what you need to set your mind to. He said, I've been in there several years now, and he says, it's working out good. He's on battleships and submarines. And he said, at least you got a place to sleep. Your clothes is no problem. You get so much money. He said, it's yours. So that was always what I wanted to do. And strange, that's what ended up.
Yes, sir. And your life would be very different without your time in the Navy in a lot of different ways. So you didn't finish high school.
No.
You went to a couple years of high school there in San Luis Obispo?
Yes. I didn't graduate from the 10th, but almost made it.
Because you had to work?
Yes. I worked every night after school. The only night I had off was Wednesday night from school till the next morning, but we had to take the bus from San Luis to Morro Bay because there's no high school them days.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to get the bus because you tried to hitchhike, but then people had a hard time picking up kids because there's always kids running away or something.
Yeah.
But I worked in the Burgers Cafe in Morro Bay. The weekends we had to work split shift because there wasn't enough business like now. So we'd go, I'd walk the beach or whatever, and that used to be the bay there where it's all got the Brocado buildings now. The water used to come up to there, and I was one of the last ones to climb Morro Rock before they closed it.
What was that like?
Fantastic, because they dredged the thing and they changed everything. My dad worked the dredger, and the blast and all that to make all the breakwater was, and then it wasn't safe there. Now watch the CC boys build the steps at the top with rails pipe to hold on to. And So I'd been climbing it for a few years, but to me it was old hand. A friend of mine told me, see, if you're going to climb it, Red, you better do it because they're going to blast day after tomorrow, and that's the last. You can't get up there anymore. So I did. I was on my split shift on Sunday. I rolled my apron up and walked down to the beach, which was a long ways. Anyway, but I went to the top and thought, gee, this is great.
So you mentioned that your uncle had been in the Navy.
Yes.
And that was somewhat of an inspiration for you. But what was the final trigger that said, you know, it's time for me to go do that. I'm going to go sign up and get in the Navy.
Well, sad choice. I had left the house because my father decided to take all my funds and appropriate and bought a place out in the country. And I'm without a car then on the coast. I had a Model T. I paid $10 for it. I could run it down through the dunes and no problem. But I couldn't run on highways. Not only no license, but and nothing. So I couldn't go to where he bought this place. So this kid was coming in with this recruiter and said, hey, Red wants to join the Navy. And he said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 17. He says, well, he says, the problem is I have to get your parental consent and they have to sign it and some waivers and things. And I said, okay. So I said, he left for Yuma. I don't know where, but if you can find him, get him to sign it, I'm in like a bandit. He said, okay. So that's when I joined the Navy.
So that was 1943?
Yes.
You signed up.
September 1st.
Usually when I talk to veterans, they describe getting into the military and having to make an adjustment, that life in the military was a notch above on the toughness scale from what they were dealing with before. But I'm thinking maybe for you it was more of a vacation.
Shove. Yeah, it was. It's a satisfaction. I didn't have to worry about a place to sleep. I knew that I was going to eat, and I wanted to be a cook because my father was a cook.
Was the Bismarck Sea your first ship, or were you on another one before
that?
No, that
was the first one.
The USS Bismarck Sea, which has the distinction of being the last American carrier sunk during World War II.
Right.
You were aboard it when that happened. We're going to hear about it. But tell me, first of all, what it was like to be on a ship that big and have the responsibilities that you had.
Well, you pass it around because, see, I was a second class, eventually, cook. Mm-hmm. And I'd have my watch, and you're only as good as the people that work for you. Main thing is the time element, because you get up just like anybody. Someday you don't feel good, and two or three guys are halfway sick, and then you try to figure out, are they really sick, or are they just saying that because they don't really want to work today? You can't fire them because you've no place where you're going to leave them. And they frown on people throwing people over the side in the middle of the ocean. They don't like that.
So you never tried that one?
No, but we would transfer them to islands, and they didn't like that either. I always had a crew of 12 to 14 men, and out of that, there might be 11 that pay attention. The rest of them, you just let them do their thing, but then they never get any favors.
Makes sense.
You learn personalities right quick.
What happened for you if general quarters sounded? Where'd you have to go?
Well, I used to be on the 40-millimeter as a loader, but that worked for a few months till I got in a little jackpot because we were ready to secure, and Chow wasn't ready. So they said, well, we got a second-class ship's cook there, a third loader. How much sense does it take to lift up that heavy shells he can't hardly lift anyway and give them to the next guy to pass him to the next guy? Wherefore, down here, he knows what's going on, and if it's not on time, he can bump it up. If it's going to be late, he's going to fix it so it won't be. So I lost my position as a third loader. I liked it topside because I could see what was going on.
Sure. And you were part of the original crew of this carrier, right?
Yeah, I'm what we call a plank owner. I got a certificate that says that I had it, and I retrieved my plank in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, we're going to hear about that. How many plank owners from the Bismarck Sea, you think, are still left?
I really don't know. We had our last reunion. It's getting to be nobody can go.
Yeah.
And so many of them went, and they're gone already. So you've got a little light around the dinner table.
So you're on this this carrier, the Bismarck Sea. You guys ship out in April of 44. What was the first incident or moment that really told you, yeah, I really am in a war?
probably the Philippine Islands. We sailed there to take MacArthur back and everything. And that's when he first discovered the kamikaze, when they first started that.
Yeah.
First, they sent a motorboat out full of dynamite, and it blew up, and we couldn't figure out what's going on. Someone awful careless.
How close was that to you?
Just in the rear. I don't know how many yards. We could still see the vessel.
And are you topside for this?
In and out. I was out as much as I could ever be, no matter where I was at.
Yeah.
And I even slept topside on the flight deck at night. I'd take my bag and carry it topside and get under the wing of a plane. I'd sleep up there at night because it was nice and cool and no one to mess with you. But anyway, then the Omni Bay was behind us and it got hit.
Yeah.
Then all the smoke come up from that. And then it dawned on me, well, we can get shot. We can get blown up.
Were there times where you were confronted with loss of life, where maybe some of your guys' planes didn't come back, or you heard some stories?
That would be, but they would even crash on the deck and go over the side, or the landing gear, one part would be on one port, and the other starboard, and stay there a month till it got washed off. And those kind of things, it was very disturbing. Then it become hairy when you come back, there's a 2-foot hole in the wing or something. You think, well, how in the devil did he fly that thing? And I was topside all the time, I'll tell you the truth. I was chased out of more than once. But being a cook, I had a lot of friends because naturally you want to be friend with the guy that's trying to feed you.
And especially you just, if you want seconds.
Yeah, and you know, you try to be good. And I was topside because I enjoyed it, what I was doing. It was a job, but I enjoyed doing what I was doing. I felt important. So I was topside all the time when I got a chance. And when they locked me in compartments, all the battle going on, you hear just a little bit of stuff. And you're not privileged to a walkie-talkie or something. You don't know what's going on. So you're just there. You hear something. You think, well, we didn't hit any land because there's none out here. So what did we hit that hard? It had to be a submarine or something. Mm-hmm. Or one of our own DS that lost control and steered right into us. So you don't know. So it's a guessing game. But that, I think, was the interesting part. You just didn't know what was going to happen.
So you much preferred being able to see and experience
that.
Yeah, things.
It's just like you get in a typhoon. Until you experience that, there's no way that you can imagine the feeling of being upside down and backwards. And then you'd hear guys, come back, come back, come back. Then the ship would kind of right, and everybody, you could just hear that all the way through. And you think, well, I'm not the only scared grown person, and I'm not even part grown yet.
Yeah, it's an important note to remember. Here you are, you're not even 20 years old yet when all this is going on. Off of what you said with going topside and sleeping under the wings of the plane, and you see some planes with holes in them, you know, some planes are skidding off the edge, some are not coming back. What kind of impression did that leave you with of the guys who are out there flying those planes?
That they had a lot of guts and a lot of skill, but then a few times you think, gee, I wish I could have been smart enough to go to flight school. And then you belittle yourself because you can't, you never will. So you accept what you are, but they can't cook a meal either. So it's 50-50. We can't trade jobs, but you can't get mine, and I'm darn sure can't get yours.
He tells it like it is, doesn't he? Albert Henderson, our guest today, known at USS Bismarck Sea reunions over the years as the Naked Cook. Where did that nickname come from? Well, we're going to find out when he takes us back to the day that that aircraft carrier sank. Find photos and videos of Mr. Henderson at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.